This is Jeff Blankford with the April 12, 2017 edition of Takes on the World, a program on international affairs that comes your way on KZYX and Z, the second and fourth Wednesdays of each month, and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to get your takes on the world. On an August morning in 1964, after President Johnson told the American people that the Vietnamese had launched an attack on a U.S. destroyer in the Gulf of Tonkin, a friend where I worked asked for my opinion on the event. "It didn't happen," I told her. "Do you know more than President Johnson?" she asked. "No," I told her. He knows it didn't happen either. Accusing the North Vietnamese of open aggression on the high seas, he sent the Senate a resolution that authorized him to take all necessary measures to repel any armed attack against the forces of the United States and to prevent further aggression, end quote. The resolution was quickly approved by Congress, with only Senators Wayne Morse of Oregon and Ernest Gruening of Alaska voting against it. Many of you will remember Johnson, as he was running for president, telling the American public that he was not going to send American boys to fight and die in Vietnam, end quote. He was, as they say, lying through his teeth. One of his first acts after taking office, after President Kennedy's assassination, was to countermand JFK's orders to bring home 1,000 U.S. troops to Vietnam as the beginning of a phased U.S. withdrawal. By the spring of 1964, just months after his death, the Pentagon had developed detailed plans for major attacks on North Vietnam, but at that time Johnson and his advisors feared that the American public would not support an expansion of the war. Fabricating a North Vietnamese attack in the Gulf of Tonkin was the answer. Their thinking was much like the neocons of the Project for New American Century brought into the George Bush administration in 2001 by Dick Cheney. Led by Paul Wolfowitz and Richard Pearl, they had earlier realized that to get the American public behind their plans to overthrow Saddam Hussein and redraw the map of the Middle East, for Israel's benefit, I should note, required a Pearl Harbor-like event, which of course they got on September 11th. What was obscene and inexcusable was that Lulu Garcia Navarro, host of this past Sunday's weekend edition on National Propaganda Radio, invited Wolfowitz to comment as a guest expert on Friday's attack by the Navy on the Syrian Air Force Base. "I think it was impressive, some people might say surprisingly impressive," said the unrepentant Chicken Hawk. "But it was, for a brand new administration, it was, to put it all together, that quickly, and to do it that well, I think, is something to be very pleased as an American. It was limited and proportional, but nevertheless, it was strong and sent a very strong message. They did it without U.S. ground troops and with no U.S. military casualties, which is very important. But I think what also may be the most important thing in all of this," said Wolfowitz, "is that when the U.S. acts decisively, it changes the way everybody thinks." "But what should happen next, if anything, in your view?" Garcia Navarro asked him. "Well, I'm sure they have many ideas," Wolfowitz replied. "I don't think they need a lot of speculation from me. But what I would say is this, that because of the change in attitudes, which is really very striking, we have, not surprisingly, our European allies stepping up and praising us, our Asian allies also. Even in Iraq, U.S. senior political leaders calling for Assad to resign. I think the Russians have started to back away from that ridiculous claim that they were supporting of the Syrians, that this was a rebel poison factory that was attacked," end quote. Well, there was more in the same vein from Wolfowitz and only a pathetic reference to the debacle in Iraq from Garcia Navarro. I will have more to report further on Wolfowitz's claim that the Russians and Syrian position is quote-unquote ridiculous. To compound what was an insult to everyone, be they Iraqi or American, victimized by the U.S. on Iraq, war on Iraq, NPR's news department elected to replay Wolfowitz's comments as a part of its headlines. Well, I don't know if Trump actually believes the scenario of Syria's alleged dropping of bombs containing deadly sarin gas near the opposition Idlib last week, and frankly doubt whether the truth matters to him. There are, however, a lot of questions about it that the national media, from liberal to conservative, has pointedly failed to acknowledge, while inexcusably ignoring the potential for a war with nuclear-armed Russia that a replication of Friday's attack might engender. Yesterday, 22 members of VIPS, the Veterans Intelligence Professionals for Peace, many of whom, like Phil Giraldi and Ray McGovern, you have heard before on Takes on the World, and Joy LeClaire's Forthright Radio, sent President Trump a memorandum. The subject was Syria, Was it really a chemical weapons attack? And beneath it, the memo contained 15 numbered arguments that they want Trump to consider, the first two of which sum up the essence of the situation. Quote, "We write to you to give you an unambiguous warning of the threat of armed hostilities with Russia, with a risk of escalation to nuclear war. The threat has grown after the cruise missile attack on Syria in retaliation for what you claim was a chemical weapons attack on April 4th on Syrian civilians in southern Idlib province." End quote. That was number one. Second, our U.S. Army contacts in the area have told us that this is not what happened. There was no Syrian chemical weapons attack. End quote. Instead, they say a Syrian aircraft bombed an al-Qaeda in Syria ammunition depot that turned out to be full of noxious chemicals, and a strong wind blew the chemical-laden cloud over a nearby village where many consequently died. End quote. There is more, and I will be discussing it in this critical situation with another one of the signatories and a previous Takes on the World guest as well, former FBI Special Agent Colleen Rowley, at 20 minutes past the hour. Rowley first came to the public's attention when she openly criticized the FBI for its failure to properly evaluate and follow up on crucial intelligence information that was available before the attacks of 9/11. This weekend, Rowley wrote that, quote, "The neocon warmongers aligned with the liberal interventionist have been given clear sailing. My sense is it's full steam ahead now for the warmongers to include risky threatening brinkmanship with Russia. It's a nuclear game of chicken with Russia," she says. "Given that all our warhawk psychopaths, with their insane hubris, are gambling that Russia will blink first, does not result in Russia backing down, we will soon be engulfed in full-boat World War III, a nuclear World War III," end quote. That's the concern of Colleen Rowley, and it should be ours and that of every American, not to mention every sentient being on the planet. We'll be hearing more from her 20 minutes past the hour, as I said, so stay tuned. For those who remain convinced that the Syrians were responsible for the gas attack, I offer the following critique of the government's case by Colonel Patrick Lang, a retired senior officer of U.S. military intelligence and U.S. Army Special Forces in Vietnam, that I suspect was one of the sources for the veteran intelligence professional's memo. Lang served in the Department of Defense both as an officer and then as a member of the Defense Senior Executive Service for many years, receiving a presidential citation for his service. His article originally appeared on the website PopularResistance.org, but you are unfortunately not likely to read or hear what Lang had to say, so I'm going to quote him extensively here. "Donald Trump's decision to launch cruise missile strikes on a Syrian Air Force base was based on a lie," writes Lang. "In the coming days, the American people will learn that the intelligence community knew that Syria did not drop a military chemical weapon on innocent civilians in Idlib. Here's what happened," writes Lang. 1. The Russians briefed the United States on the proposed target. This is a process that started more than 2 months ago. There is a dedicated phone line that is being used to coordinate and deep conflict, that is, prevent U.S. and Russian air assets from shooting at each other, to deconflict the upcoming operation. 2, United States was fully briefed on the fact that there was a target in Idlib that the Russians believed was a weapons explosion depot for Islamic rebels. 3, the Syrian Air Force hit the target with conventional weapons. All involved expected to see a massive secondary explosion. That did not happen. Instead, chemical smoke, began billowing from the site. It turns out that the Islamic rebels used that site to store chemicals, not sarin, that were deadly. The chemicals included organic phosphates and chlorine, and they followed the wind and killed civilians. 4. There was a strong wind blowing that day, and the cloud was driven to a nearby village and caused casualties. 5. We know it was not sarin. How? Very simple. The so-called first responders handled the victims without gloves. If that had been sarin, they would be dead. Sarin on the skin will kill you. How do I know? I went through live agent training at Fort McClellan in Alabama. There are members of the U.S. military who are aware that the strike would occur, and it was recorded, writes Lang. There is a film record. At least the Defense Intelligence Agency knows that this was not a chemical weapons attack. In fact, Syrian military chemical weapons were destroyed with the help of Russia. This is a Gulf of Tonkin too, writes Colonel Pat Lang. How ironic, he notes. Donald Trump correctly castigated George W. Bush for launching an unprovoked, unjustified attack on Iraq in 2003. Now we have President Donald Trump doing the same damn thing. Worse, in fact. Because the intelligence community had information showing that there was no chemical weapon launched by the Syrian Air Force. Here's the good news, according to Lang. The Russians and Syrians were informed, or at least were aware, that the attack was coming, and they were able to remove a large number of their assets. The base with the United States hit was something of a backwater. Donald Trump gets to pretend that he's a tough guy. He's not. He's a fool. The attack, points out Pat Lang, was a violation of international law. Donald Trump authorized an unjustified attack on a sovereign country. What is even more disturbing, he says, is that people like Secretary of Defense Jim Mattis, CIA Director Mike Pompeo, and NSA Director General McMaster went along with this charade. But the fault is not his alone, points out Lang. Those who sit atop the NSC, the DOD, the CIA, and the Department of State should have resigned in protest. They did not. They are complicit in a war crime, end quote. Those were the words of Patrick Lang, a retired, highly decorated former U.S. Army colonel who served with U.S. military intelligence and special forces in Vietnam in the Department of Defense and the Defense Intelligence Agency. He was trained and educated as a Middle East specialist by the U.S. Army and served in that region for many years, becoming the first professor of the Arabic language at West Point. Despite those credentials, you are not likely to see or hear him interviewed by any of the mainstream media, and certainly not on NPR, which I am certain is too valuable to the political establishment to have its funding cut despite President Trump's threats to do so. Owen Jones, writing in The Guardian, observes that, quote, a press Trump denounced as liars and enemies of the people are eating out of his hands, tiny or otherwise. I think Donald Trump became president of the United States, cooed CNN commentator Fareed Zakaria, in response to the bombing. Trump, quote, reacted viscerally to the images of the death of innocent children in Syria, declared Mark Sandler in the New York Times. The original headline in that article read, on Syria attack, Trump's heart came first. So the man who once bragged to obeying audience that he would tell five-year-old Syrian refugees to their faces that the U.S. would not offer them safety is now driven by his heart, writes a disbelieving Owen Jones. Touching indeed, he writes, cynically, and then goes on to quote the Washington Post David Ignatius, who says, now the moral dimension of leadership had penetrated Trump's Oval Office. Having consistently supported the government in every war and overseas adventure and repeating its handouts as if they consisted of facts and not lies, the argument can be made that the establishment media is indeed the enemy of the American people. Since my last program, there have been two important conferences in Washington involving the pro-Israel lobby and its influence on U.S. Middle East policy, one of which you heard or read little of substance about, and the other about which you heard nothing at all. The first conference was the one you heard nothing at all about. It was held at the National Press Club on March 24th, had a diverse array of noted speakers addressing the issues created by the second conference. Titled The Israel Lobby and American Foreign Policy and sponsored by IRMEP, the Institute for Research Middle East Policy, and the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs, the very best U.S. publication on the Middle East, it featured, among others, Hanan Ashrawi, a veteran political activist from Palestine, Israeli historian Alan Pape, John Mearsheimer, co-author of the groundbreaking book on the Israel lobby, and IRMEP's director Grant Smith, a frequent guest on this program. Inasmuch as criticism of the Israel lobby is among the most honored taboos of the U.S. media, which also includes Democracy Now!, there was no coverage of the conference in the media. It can, however, be viewed from beginning to end in its entirety at IRMEP, that's IRMEP.org, or by selecting the speakers individually. I hardly recommend it. And there's also much more on that website about the Israel lobby that you will not find anywhere else. The second conference, billed as AIPAC's policy conference, is the closest thing to a Nuremberg convention that the capital sees annually, with the attendance each year far exceeding the one before it. Last year, for example, there were 16,000 attendees. This year, 18,000, and on both occasions, 4,000 of these were student leaders from colleges across the country that AIPAC, by paying their way to Washington and treating them with kid gloves, hopes to turn into mouthpieces for Israel, something that in itself would merit a congressional investigation, since the last time I looked, Israel was a foreign country. Of course, Congress would not ever think of doing that because it has arguably long been Israel's most important occupied territory. What other lobby, foreign or domestic, could have the vice president and the leaders from the House and Senate from both political parties as featured speakers? As if to shamelessly prove the power, its power, each year more than half the members of Congress attend the AIPAC conference and have their names solemnly read off as if they were on an honor roll. The reasoning behind that obscene ritual, of course, is to let donors who put Israel's interests first and foremost know the names of members of Congress that will do the same and who can be bought. To see how AIPAC does it, you can watch speakers from its conference at AIPAC.org. To be fair, buying a member of Congress is like a timeshare, because with but a handful of exceptions, he or she will also do the bidding of every corporation that comes calling. As the great cowboy humorist Will Rogers supposedly said early in the last century, we have the best Congress money can buy, or perhaps you prefer what Mark Twain wrote back in 1907, quote, it could probably be shown by facts and figures that there is no distinctly American criminal class except Congress. And who's to argue with Mark Twain? And look for Jeff Blankford. Thanks for listening.